I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back. My guest today is a wonderful friend, introduced by a wonderful friend. You remember Simon Ong, who was here on the podcast. After our conversation on the podcast, we became very, very, very close friends. He's a wonderful human being. His work is amazing. And he just keeps referring and connecting and introducing me to the most wonderful people, one of which is my guest today. My guest today is Simone Heng, who is a former international broadcaster. So for 15 years of her life, she was on Virgin Radio in Dubai, on HBO Asia, on CNBC, and many other on-air types of communication. So she looks at herself as a sort of a connection specialist, someone that teaches the world how to connect. And I have to admit, the first time we met, I could see that very, very, very clearly. You know, you feel that charisma, that comfort around Simone. And she really is a brilliant, very intelligent woman who really sees the world in a way that makes a big difference. Her book, Let's Talk About Loneliness, is a very valuable resource to talk about what is really a pandemic in our times today, loneliness. Simone is a speaker that really inspires her audience to connect. She spoke to tens of thousands of people, including, of course, many Fortune 500 organizations. But to me, she's really an incredibly enjoyable intellectual encounter every time we meet. So I hope today you will get a little bit of that. Simone is born in Singapore, currently based in Singapore, but she was raised in Australia, studied in Switzerland, and lived, of course, when she was on Virgin Radio here in Dubai. She truly is one of my favorite conversationalists. So I hope you will enjoy this today as much as I do. Simone, thank you so much for joining me. You're in Singapore today, aren't you? You're probably one of the very few worse travelers than I am. I mean, in the last months, you were in America, in the UK. You went to quite a few places.
Yeah, I had to go back to Singapore for two engagements in between the Northern Hemisphere, which was frustrating. I think I overestimate that I'm almost 40. Like, I overestimate what my body can do. And I learned a big lesson.
People, if you're listening to this on the podcast, look on YouTube so that you understand that, you know, Singaporean genes, this woman is not 40 and her body as compared to mine can take quite a bit more beating.
No, you were the forebearer of this news when we met in London, and you were like the stress to my body. And I just got in from Thailand yesterday doing a keynote, and I really thought of you, Mo, and I was like, okay, next year it'll be different. I will not do any unnecessary travel. So yeah, there might be holidays, and then there's business engagements, but nothing that's, you know, I fly a lot for courses and education. I won't be doing that next year. Like, my body needs to rest. And I was just listening to a podcast that said, when you don't sleep for 5 nights in a row, you eat 20% more.
Is that true?
Every day.
Oh, that's and right. There you go, people. Here's the explanation for my little belly. It's very clear.
Well, my belly too. This is what happens is I do a speaking engagement. I pass out in the hotel room, then I order room service. In this case, it was like mango sticky rice, right? I was in Phuket, and then a burger and whatever. And like, I'm craving those calories to keep me awake to go to like the gala in the evening. And it's just not a sustainable way. And I should talk to our friend Simon, who does energy management on this. in that, like, you can do a little bit of it. We all have peak season, but just doing it as much as I did in 2023 with the book launch is not advisable. I won't be doing that in 2024.
It's quite interesting because, you know, end of the year, December mainly is my reflection month. So I really look back at my previous year, attempt to find out what I would change next year. And I did have a conversation with my business manager, Munir, to say this was unsustainable, completely undoable. And I ended up, as you would imagine I do, I ended up asking him to limit the number of travel days next year. And so I gave him a target and said, please, let's not exceed that target. And he actually said, oh, that's more than this year. And I was like, oh, man, you know, my brain is just not clever enough when it comes to, you know, protecting myself from those things. So he was kind enough to
say, your brain is magnificent. I think we need to have a moment that you have to be. I saw you on Diary of a CEO and I was like, that is the most magnificent mind. Oh, and so as someone who's a communicator, anyone who can articulate in their second language exactly what they want to say, how they want to say it with such impact, for me is always jaw-dropping, because obviously English is my first language and I speak German badly, but I feel how exhausting that is for me. And I just think how smart you have to be so competent as a communicator. Yeah, your mind. Don't ever slam your mind. Then all the rest of us have to make fun of our minds.
This is very kind of you. I find it quite interesting because I actually don't want to talk. So, you know, I try to get the least amount of words out. And I think that's really why people think I'm articulate. It's like, can we just get done with this? And then I shut up again, go back to my side.
Are you an introvert, Mo?
Are you kidding me? I'm the ultimate introvert.
You're so charismatic. But then again, we met one-on-one. So I have not seen you actually in a group environment, which would make things a lot more clear to me. But one-on-one, you're sparkling, right?
I mean, one-on-one is also very, very introverted. So introverts actually cherish, you know, very close relationships. So to me, it's just when there are a lot of people in the room, and often I am in rooms of 12,000 people, it doesn't intimidate me or anything. But at the end of the day, I feel that I've had to exert energy to be in that place. It didn't give me energy. And often, of course, because I love how kind people are to me. So sometimes I would have to spend 3-4 hours afterwards just greeting everyone and saying hi and so on. I assure you, by the time I get back to my hotel, I'm not even able to, like, pick the phone to order room service. It's like I'm done, battery flat completely.
I'm getting close to that, even though I'm an extrovert. But I think it's just the wearing down across the year. It doesn't start like that. I mean, February, I'm so balanced. I'm so strong. We come out of Chinese New Year where I'm based and I'm raring to go. And then it just chips away across the course of the year. But, you know, we all have dreams, right? So the lifestyle I lived this year, international book launch, speaking all over the world, this was my dream 5 years ago at the tail end of my media career.
Yeah.
And then that is the human condition to, okay, see the fruition of the dream and actually realize, oh, the back end of that dream is actually not as much to my liking. I'm still very grateful, but it's worn on me, and then we adjust.
I think that's super true. You know, the idea, and I keep telling people that, especially when I speak about money, it is when you tell people who may not have had a lot of money that money really doesn't matter beyond your basic needs, that all you need, all you do afterwards is just buy a few more toys or try to artificially tell yourself that it's now safer, when, of course, money doesn't make anything safe. You know, everyone will say, okay, so just give me enough money and I'll make up my mind if what you're saying is true. You have to experience it yourself, I guess, in order to be able to see it. Simon, so the critical question probably is, while you and I are the kinds of people that will meet hundreds, if not thousands of people on a weekly basis, how lonely is it?
Oh, there is multiple types of loneliness, and it can be incredibly lonely. Loneliness is the perception of the gap between the kind and amount of human connection you want and what you're currently getting. So let's lean into like the kind that you want. For me personally, and Mo and I have a friendship, so we talk about this off air, you know, there's something called intimate connection, which is the five closest people to you. These are people you can be vulnerable with, you can have an existential crisis with, you can call these people to loan money. It's a very close filter. And a lot of people find this in the five people they cohabitate with. Now, if you're like me and you're a single woman, no partner, no children.
Did you guys hear this? She's single. Okay. Go to YouTube, right? And I'll somehow secretly put her credentials in the,
oh my goodness, stop.
In the show notes. Stop. Because I will tell you, as a friend, I recommend Simone highly. Oh, of course, if you're a real man, because she's not in, you know, she's not the kind of woman that will take anyone. Anyway, go ahead, Simone. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, kind of.
But yeah, so there's that intimate kind of connection that we need. There's also other bands of connection. And I have a quiz on simonehing.com. I write about it in the book. But, you know, if you don't have a little bit of all those five types, you can absolutely feel lonely and you can be surrounded by the wrong kinds of people. I talk about my time in Dubai during my media career, where I would just go to all these events. It's also around the time on a thread here where I discovered that it's like you talked about money. I talk about in terms of exposure, like how much platform do you want? I kind of learned that being the it girl or having a sense of notoriety or like a Z grade level of fame was just how empty it could be, right? But people who've never experienced being the it girl don't know that.
Yeah.
They just want to be it and they'll chase it forever. And even if they never get it, they'll always be chasing it. But back to this idea of, you know, I had a lot of surface level connections going to these events, being sort of like a socialite, and it didn't satiate me at all. I was deeply lonely. So you have to work out what is the kind of connection that I'm craving. Mm. And where am I going to find that? And this can go also for self-connection. So one of the types of connection I talk about is time to connect with the self. Introverts know about this really well. And so for a lot of women, for example, my friends are married with kids, they're working, even getting that gap of time to even check with themselves, to even say, am I lonely? Am I enjoying the life I'm living now? Is really hard for them to even get. So yes, you can be meeting as many people as we meet now and absolutely be lonely. The stats, I think from the US, is 1 in 3 people are lonely. It's huge.
I mean, it really is the pandemic. I think one of pandemics, I think the idea that we started to hide behind little screens and just assume that this is some form of human connection, I think is really screwing all of us.
There's no studies as well to support that the same chemicals we get from in-person connection, that dopamine, that oxytocin, that we get the same levels from going through the screen. We get some, but not the levels that we need to satiate us. And now we're all living very siloed. We are digitally connected. That does not mean at all that we are having that very special human connection that we evolved. Like Homo sapiens thrived and became the dominant species by our ability to work and strive together and connect together. And so this goes down to our DNA. It's in us at a cellular level.
Yeah.
And even the most introverted of us needs connection. So you can see how we're living is unprecedented in the scheme of how we evolved.
Correct. I mean, it's quite interesting because I almost tend to believe that human connection is almost a survival. First of all, it's a survival mechanism, but it's a signal of safety. So the idea that I have someone nearby, even if it's just a few people, right, or even one person, just sort of tells me, okay, you know what, with my weaknesses as a human being, the flimsiest animal in the jungle, I can actually survive because we can back each other up, sort of.
Yeah, so Dr. James Cone, this incredible scientist, he actually did a study. I won't go into it, but the study reveals that when we're with a high quality connection, okay, not someone that we don't get along with, someone that we consider a trusted friend, our brain actually counts their bioenergetic resources as part of our own. Okay. So that means I'm about, yeah. So their energy, their ability, as we undertake a task, if I get injured, my brain is actually counting the probability of me getting injured and the probability of them being able to support me on whatever quest we're going. It's absolutely fascinating. So we literally, when you've been an expat, you've lived outside of your own country, like Mo and I have repeated times, you'll notice about the 90-day mark when you move to a new country, your mind goes, hey, I need to go out and make friends. You start getting really itchy, even the most introverted, to go and socialize. That loneliness is the body's alarm saying, I'm without connections. I have less bioenergetic resources. I'm not as safe. Let me go out and connect. But people who are lonely all the time, not just an alarm like that, they have the fight or flight hormones, the stress hormones in their body perpetually, which is why you have all these stats like loneliness is more dangerous than smoking 15 cigarettes a day, or having an alcohol use habit, or being obese, because that low level anxiety, that low level fight or flight response is going through people for decades at a time, destroying their immunity, leading to life shortening disorders. So you can see how this all goes back to how we evolved. Mm. Because if you were cast out of the tribe, you would not survive long.
Yeah.
The saber-toothed tiger would pick you off, or you would get lost. I could go on forever. There's so many things, and I don't want to bore people with the science. It excites me, but I don't know if it's going to excite everyone. But it's all in the book. There's loads in the book.
You say there are five types of connection. So can you list those quickly so I pick the ones that I think are very juicy?
Yeah, and these are curated across like all the studies that I've read. They come up again and again and again. And I'm probably just the kind of first person that just kind of put them together. So the first is self-connection, which we spoke about before. This is connection with yourself and awareness of one's own experience at any time, because you can't connect well with other people if you have no idea about what's going on with you. And we've seen this. All the relationships we've ever destroyed are based on a less than optimal state in us that maybe we were not detecting. So that's self-connection. The next is intimate connections. These are those five closest people to you that see you literally. You could go to the toilet in front of them and they would forgive you. You know, the people that you live with could be your daughter, your wife, whatever it is. After that, we have something called relational connection. This is belonging to a social fabric. So we see this with mutual care. So say you are a little old lady, you're crossing the road and you drop your groceries all over the road. Someone in your community comes to help you. So this is this idea of mutual care, or you can call your neighbor to borrow a cup of sugar. We don't actually live in communities like this anymore, and our cities are not planned to enable this anymore. Mm. So we see a lot of loneliness around this. This relational connection. The next is collective connection. So this one is fascinating. This is where you don't have to be best buddies with anyone. You don't have to tell them all your deepest, darkest secrets, but you have a thread of commonality. So maybe they're the people you go gaming with, or they're the people in your religious group, or they're the people that you go cycling with. So you don't have to disclose your deepest, darkest secrets, but you have that thread. And this should never be underestimated, because people who lack collective connection have been known to join extremist groups, or they join gangs, because they feel that their family doesn't understand that very important thread that they want to have seen in them. And the final is micro connections. This is when you just nod at your barista at Starbucks. This is when you're acknowledged by someone when you cross the road. And we really miss these during the pandemic. You do get oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin from these small, seemingly unimportant daily interactions. For a very lonely person that doesn't feel they have any friends, an acknowledgement while crossing the street could change the whole day for them.
Yeah.
So we need all of these five types. And I feel that we need a little bit of all these five types to be socially well connected.
You haven't mentioned romantic connections. So do you include
them? They go intimate.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So does that mean it's irrelevant if you have a romantic partner or not, as long as you have the intimate five people that you're close to?
Because, of course, a lot of people, even who have the romantic partners, can still register loneliness, because they can have a perception that they're not fully seen or fully connected to that romantic partner. And specifically, if it's a low-quality relationship, they're not getting the benefits of the connection from that romantic partner as well. So it's more about that feeling of closeness, where you can be vulnerable with that five, versus whether it's romantic or not.
That's really, really interesting. I think very key when you really think about it, the idea that, I think the way you're saying it is that you could have the romantic partner but not feel that you have intimate connections, and you could not have the romantic partner but feel that you do. And I think
Absolutely. I think that's very true.
I think that would be such a relief on romantic relationships when you really think about it, because of the idea that so many people are looking for that one person that will fulfill all of their needs. When in reality, what we're saying is that your human connection needs are not limited to one person. And as a matter of fact, when someone sort of prevents you from having the other four connections, you might actually be having a very bad deal by having an intimate connection with them.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you picked that up, because the reason I added this chapter in, this is the remix of a book that I wrote that was published in Asia. Okay. And one of Secret Pandemic. So the chapter that I added on these five types was because I kept seeing on Instagram people proliferating this myth that you need to get all your connection needs from your boyfriend. It was particularly from female-led accounts. And all the studies show us that that's absolutely not true. And there are also studies that show, again, Dr. James Cone, he did a study of people in a high-quality romantic relationship, one hand holding the partner and the other hand being zapped with an electric shock. And then the control group was people holding the hand of just a random caregiver, a nurse or a helper. And then they also did a further study where they had people in not so quality romantic relationships, okay, people having issues or there was a lacking of trust. The only people, the people that had the not high quality relationship did not register any additional benefits beyond what the hired caregiver had. The people in the quality relationship, however, the pain receptors in the brain detected less pain when they were holding the hand of high quality relationship. So that goes to show who you pick as a partner, the benefit is the quality of that relationship. That's really, really important.
What would you count as quality? So what would make a relationship quality relationship?
I don't know. The study doesn't go into that, but I assume from the human connection work that I've done that it's around trust. I think trust is a really, really high one, because we can't have connection without trust. But the study didn't break it down further than that. Just use the terminology high quality relationship.
To me, honestly, that's spot on, right? Because you know what? Let's stay on that romantic type. You get that. I think most people would go into romantic relationships looking for sort of happiness, if you want, right? It's like he makes me or she makes me happy. And that would make the relationship quality, at least at the beginning. Then the idea that you keep that without trust basically almost erodes the relationship so quickly. And when you start to lose what is sort of given at the beginning, which is, oh, the fun and right, you can't work through the other things because you can't express what your challenges are or what your needs are and so on. And I think that idea of, I trust that we will work on this together. I trust that we will, right? And I don't think this is only romantic. I think what really, really constitutes a deep friendship is it's okay to disagree. It's okay to have different points of view. And it's actually okay to sometimes fight a little bit. You know, that's what it's all about. And maybe even strengthens things a little more. It's just, I trust that we are there for each other, even if there are a few waves on the way, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's that, I love that where you said, it's healthy to argue. And I think my most wonderful friendships, this is, could be also my personality type though.
I was just going the to friendships say.
I do like to be challenged,
I know.
In terms of, I live in a world of an algorithm that sends me all the people's posts who are just like me. Mm-hmm. That's enough. Like, I can't control that the algorithm wants to do that, but I can control who I put in my life to not be like that algorithm to me in person, because it doesn't make me.
That's such an amazing statement.
Is it?
That's such an amazing statement. Actually, it goes much deeper than friendships. But what you're saying here, if you guys understood it like I did, is that because the world is now sort of muting any different opinion to yours on social media, they're just showing you the stuff that you seem to like and click on and stick with, you probably would benefit from having people in your life that are seeing other things and have other opinions, so that they come in and say, hey, by the way, this is not, what you see is not the whole truth, right? Or it's not even the truth at all.
Look, the first moment I sat down with Mo, I told him that I don't drink coffee and have never drunk. I have drunk coffee once and it made me speak really, really quickly. And as a broadcaster, this is not ideal. So I drink green tea, and it helps that I live in Asia where tea is everywhere, right? And so I haven't been confronted with my non-pro coffee views in a long, long time. And Mo argued really persuasively around why I should try to drink coffee. And we just, and I love that. I just think there's a great exercise I'm writing about in my second book now, which is all about self-connection. And I talk about, and many famous spiritual people before me have written about it. I think I've just written about it in a very accessible way. But I talk about when I went on a date with a guy and I didn't agree with his views, but I do this thing where I go into the mode of the observer. So instead of getting triggered or argumentative or defensive, I just go into the observer. So I can literally feel my consciousness go through the back of me and be on my shoulder. And I am observing and I'm listening. I'm not saying anything. I'm also trying not to judge and trying to observe what is being said here that I could possibly learn from. And I think our world has become very closed to those people who don't agree with us. It's become very extreme and very polarized. And so I think it helps being an Asian woman in Asia, where that's kind of been our model, our ideal model to us since the beginning of our culture, that we should be that observer. And that's not naturally my character, but that's something that has happened to me as I've lived outside of where I grew up. And I love that. I love that I can still be open. And I don't get that everywhere that I travel. I observe a lot when I travel, and it's not there are some places in the world now where just people are not hearing each other. So I think that's a great gift. So next time somebody comes up with views that you don't agree with, instead of jumping to any sort of immediate reaction, just play the observer.
I think if you ask me if anything has really given me the knowledge that I have in life, it's that. Right. And, you know, I'm old enough to actually recognize that there were views that were told to me when I was maybe 20, where I said, come on, I hate that this person is saying this. But anyway, it's their point of view. It could be valid. They have a different perspective than mine. And then in my 40s or 50s, I started to say, oh, my God, that's actually the truth. Right. And these are seismic shifts in my life, right? You know, my relationships to spirituality, my relationships to, you know, love and romance and other, so many big topics to work. Yeah, I spent my entire life with a very specific relationship to work that was mainly dictated by Harvard Business Review and the likes, right? When in reality, I mean, look at me, I'm a freaking monk. I don't want any of that in my life, right? And I think the idea of us just sitting lovingly and saying, I don't agree with this, but I'll just keep it in compartment two, as I always call it, you know, which is, I don't agree and I don't disagree with it. I'll just keep it in the back there and just think about it as we go along. I think that's really what life is all about. What happened to coffee, Simone? Did we change?
Oh, no, I just very broadcastery of me changed the subject to something else. But you see, I've compartmentalized. I haven't forgotten it. So it's also about not dismissing what other people say. It's like it's still there. Okay, and maybe so I'm just processing.
For those who are listening, we shall now interrupt this conversation for me to have a heart-to-heart conversation with Simone about coffee, because coffee is religious to me. No, it's not actually. I mean, it is to me, it's actually a very interesting topic to connect, because, you know, you can love coffee or not, but there is so much passion within me for it, right? That I can talk about it in a way that will get you to know me in a way, and then ask you a few things about you that will get me to know you in a way that is really all about how you see yourself, how you connect to yourself, which interestingly is the most important topic, really.
I always say to people as well, when I speak to audiences, that if you're ever looking for a topic to connect with other humans on, that is a safe topic in this very volatile world we live in. Take a look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs and that food, water, shelter, above that love, connection, and belonging. So these are universal things that humans like. So I say when foreigners come to Asia, if you want to make Singaporean friends, ask them to tell you where the best place to eat is. And this is the same. Your coffee conversation goes in that conversation. Mm. And if you want to use those topics as a gateway to deeper connection, they're a great place to start because no one's going to have an outright rage at you because they don't drink coffee. Like I, you know what I mean? Like I found it fascinating that you were so passionate about it. And I could just as well also have, if I wanted to monopolize more of the time we had that day, tell you all about my favorite teas and why I like them. You know, it's a fantastic conversation because it also obviously discloses something about you as well.
Yeah, it's what I normally refer to as a low stake conversation. So it's, you know, if someone gets upset because you spoke to them about coffee or tea, then probably that's enough of a warning sign for
them.
It's like, you know, that's not going to be a good connection.
Run. Exactly.
And I think low stake conversations are probably one of the interesting, you know, cures to loneliness. But we'll go to cures in a minute. Why do you think we're failing so much? Why is one in every three people lonely?
Yeah, I think firstly, the way that our cities are planned now have changed. So if we look historically, townships were planned around like a central piazza, place of worship. Our cities are no longer planned that way. So you're not getting that incidental connection.
Interesting.
We're also completely siloed with our technology. And now with all these delivery services of food coming to your house, you really have no reason to be leaving the home. So that means all of your connection is done via digital means, which means they're also contrived. So for example, Simon Sinek's spoken a lot about this, and I love this. He talks about the fact that he spoke to some Gen Zs and they said, yeah, we have phone conversations. He said, well, what do you mean? And they meant that they send voice notes back and forth, but it's not a real-time conversation. So in that I voice note Mo voice notes me a day later, there's a whole 24 hours in between to mediate, position, and essentially make inauthentic your response. This also then leads to a social anxiety when you have to meet people in real time and you cannot conduct a real-time conversation because you're not even picking up the phone anymore. You're using voice notes. So we think these are modalities given to us to help us connect. For some people who've never had any experience with living in an analog world, this can be absolutely impeding their social skills. So this is also, modernity is what the US Surgeon General, I was just at Harvard at the big symposium with all the leading researchers, and modernity, and in the US particularly polarization, are what are ripping people apart. And I would say less of the polarization in our part of the world. Well, I can't speak for your part of the world, Mo. I forget that you're in Dubai, but in Southeast Asia, less of the polarization, but huge use of technology. I mean, Singapore is one of the smartest tech cities in the world. Right. We can also see this, you know, Japan, Korea. And let's add to that the layer of culture in that we're more introverted societies. I'm a total anomaly because I've had this global life. So I'm very extroverted. But for the most part, we are more introverted than other cultures. And so you can add that as another layer. Mm. Aging societies as well. So that is also going to skew statistics. But if we look at the US and Australia, the group that comes up as the loneliest of all generations is Gen Z.
Interesting.
So that points to modernity. That points to the conditions of social media and not interacting face-to-face. Yeah.
So once again, why is that? Is it because, you know, I mean, we've agreed that it's one of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, really. It's one of human needs to have love and connection and relationships. And is it because Gen Z may have never actually experienced the kind of connection that you and I have, even though, you know, we will meet, I don't know, once a year or whatever, whenever our paths cross, but at least we have that reference to have how wonderful that hug is, how wonderful that conversation is. Maybe they don't have that reference. Is it, you know, is it an awareness issue? Why is it not complaining about it?
Oh, I love that when you've said it. So have they never experienced that? So what we know is they had a very pivotal point in their adolescence disrupted by the pandemic. So this is that point, remember when we all went to high school, Mo, and we were learning our identity based off our interaction with other people.
Oh, wow.
We're asserting our identities, right? They were robbed of this. So a lot of them will talk about social anxiety. Imagine the rest of us had our social skills atrophied during a pandemic, but we were able to work those out just like you go to the gym. And then we were able to go back in and ask questions and be curious and know how to socialize. Imagine that you never knew those things, you were robbed of it, and then you were sent back into the wild. It's like keeping a tiger in your house and then expecting it to go out and fend for itself. Mm. When for its prime adolescent years, it's just, this is just all it is. You know, 2.5, 3 years.
Yeah. It's shocking how little we talk about those things, honestly. The pandemic's impact. I normally looked at the idea of children who are now, let's say, 3 or 4, which, you know, may have benefited massively from having their parents in their homes with them. But then you go to children who are, say, 7 or 8, who are supposed to go to school and are supposed to connect with other children. The challenge is not only that they were robbed of 2 years, but those 2 years really are like almost 80% of their social life. You know what I mean? And so when we talk about conditioning, how much conditioning could that have if the first 2 years of your social life you were not there at all, and now you're expected to jump in and do it all? And now that you bring up the idea of Gen Z and teens and so on, that's so eye-opening to me. I never thought of it this way, that these are character building, a bit destructive if you ask me, teen years, but destructive in a way that allows you to rebuild yourself, or at least recognize which parts of you are vulnerable. And but then the way you say it makes it almost irreparable unless we have some kind of an awakening.
So if I look at it like those are the years also that you're finding out how your values are different from those around you. So you're defining your identity based on essentially your values. And we know that when you want authentic connection, so you're taking relationship from being transactional. You know, I hate the word authentic. It gets bounced around a lot. But for the sake of this, you know, it is where you are having that deep connection, where you're able to form your own group of intimates as a young adult before you get married and all that stuff, before you form your own family. A lot of the time, if you look at your closest friends, you'll normally have that similar values, including the person you marry, very similar values. And imagine that you don't even get to work out what your values are as a teen because you're just in this silo doing class via Zoom. Those are the important years. If you look at your early adolescence, that was where you worked out, oh, Simone, you prefer, you know, reading books and education is really vital to you versus kissing a bunch of boys. Like, this is how you're different. Mm. And you work it out by being in school on the playground or whatever it is. And then all of a sudden you don't have that. So your knowledge of self is actually a bit diminished. Thanks. And that impedes your ability to judge authentic friendship too.
So what would be a few signs that should alert someone that they have a loneliness problem?
Yeah, so firstly, wanting to self-isolate. Wanting to self-isolate. That's actually part of the lonely brain's irrational spiral. So the very part of you that should be wanting to go out actually makes you self-isolate. And that's due to a second symptom, which is holding people in your life to a higher standard than is reasonable. Mm. So for example, why must I always call my cousin? He should call me first because in 1995, I bought him a birthday cake and he's not been there for me.
Yeah.
Okay. So stuff like this. So then of course that person is going to fail because that's a ridiculous standard that the lonely brain is telling you to set. Therefore you self-isolate further because you're like, no one understands me. Another thing is less than good quality sleep. So remember we talked about the tribe?
Yeah.
And this is really fascinating. If you were cast out of that tribe as an early human out on the savannah, you would have to rouse many times in the night to look out for saber-toothed tigers and predators.
Correct.
On your own. But when you were in connection in the tribe, other tribes people would take turns so you could sleep through the night. So they still, Dr. Louise Hawkley still uses micro awakenings in the sleep to gauge how lonely an individual is. So if you had less than good quality sleep during the pandemic, this is linked to the body saying, you are alone, you are alone, you are alone, you are out of connection. So less than good quality sleep is another one. Social anxiety, wanting desperately to be around people, but the minute you are, wanting to retreat. And misreading of social cues, a bit of social awkwardness is also a sign of loneliness. So you can see how people can be walking around wounded and not even know. It's quite subtle.
But I think what matters even more is for every one of us to look inward and say, am I struggling with those symptoms? It's so eye-opening when you really think about it. So let me talk about myself on my own. This podcast is like my constant therapy sessions. So, you know, wanting to isolate more, I don't know if that holds true for me. I barely ever get time alone anyway. So it makes...
No, you're like...
Yeah, it may sound reasonable that when I'm back in Dubai, for example, I would only let in very close friends and not even every day. And sometimes I would crave to have a few days of silence and so on. But sleep is very, 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 very obvious for me. So on the days where I feel the most lonely, I find it's not that I'm not able to sleep. It's just that I'm not really interested to go to bed at all. It's like by 10 p.m., I'm starting to think, so this day has passed. Are we going to let it pass? Maybe I should watch a documentary or, you know, learn a little bit about how to make my fish tank better or whatever. And then I find myself at 1:30 a.m. Still there, really not wanting to fall asleep. And so by the time I wake up in the morning early, because this is my alert time, I haven't had enough sleep. Does that count as a sign?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so. If you're linking that within you, this idea of, on some level, it's disrupted sleep. So, and it's a sleep procrastination based on an emotional state. So,
yeah, absolutely. I don't know if I have any social anxiety or if I struggle when I'm around people, but I can see how, you know, a younger person, perhaps if they're just constantly struggling with the complexity of, you know, I feel offbeat, but I don't know if it's exactly because of loneliness or because I ate something bad. And it's actually a very complex problem when you really think about it. But it seems to me that perhaps for everyone listening, it would be very valuable to take count, to sort of tell yourself, am I self-isolating more? Am I not sleeping well? Do I have social anxiety and I'm afraid to be with people? And am I atrophying my social skills somehow? So when I'm out there, I don't feel in flow about it anymore. These are very important signs.
Yeah, and I think that's why self-connection is the topic of my next book, because if you don't have that strong relationship with yourself and that awareness, you could just be walking around with that stress hormones. You could be lonely and you won't even realize. And so I think taking a moment, I like to do some box breathing, 4-4-8 breathing technique, slow everything right down and just do a self check-in. And I will very clearly know what's happening. My body will be an indicator and my emotional state will be an indicator. And I think everyone listening should just make sure they get 5 minutes a day, every week, if you can, to really just check in and say, am I lonely? Because the lonely brain is not rational as well. So it can start in a very insipid way. They just came out with a recent study that the World Health Organization said that if people spend more than 75% of their time alone, this is the precursor for loneliness as well. So this whole Gen Z thing that I see on TikTok when I post about human connection and they'll say, I don't need human connection. I just need Wi-Fi connection. They'll write this on my videos and they will just say, I want to be alone. I want to be alone. Leave me alone. This is that lonely brain self-isolation loop. So you'll hear a lot of the rhetoric around, I have social anxiety. I get anxious around people. But it's actually that loneliness loop. It's because you're already isolating. So then you have no social skills. Then you feel self-conscious. Then you say, okay, I might as well just not go out. But then you're lonely. So this is something that we need to look out for, which is why I'm so vocal about all these things on social media and everywhere.
That's a very, very eye-opening cycle. I think that, you know, everyone should really do a stock count exercise tonight, basically, and think about that for themselves. Do you think there is any difference between, I mean, I know there is, but what is the difference between lonely and alone? Like, you know, there is, alone is a wonderful feeling sometimes. Lonely is very, very painful. Why are they different?
So there's a difference, and I write about this in the book. There's a difference between solitude and loneliness. So solitude is where that state is selected and it's a choice, and you are conscious in choosing to be alone. Okay. And that's very healthy. Loneliness happens when, like with the pandemic, we are forced into that state of social separation and social disconnection. So it's a very One is a choice that you're conscious in, and the other one is forced upon you. And that can also mean I'm stuck in a house full of my family that I don't get along with, and I have low quality relationships with, and I therefore feel lonely. And on that subject of the family thing, I should have added where we were talking about how can we tell we're lonely. What we know is, and I write about this in my book, but so does Dr. Jeremy Noble, is that trauma is a pillar of loneliness. So if you've experienced some fractures at a very young time in your life, developmental stage, where you have not had your emotional needs met by your primary caregiver, and therefore you become suspicious of interactions with people, because of course that relationship with the primary caregiver is the first point of call where you learn whether you should trust other human beings or not, you don't get what you need, and you develop some childhood trauma. This feeds into becoming lonely later in life because it affects how you relate to other people. So, my book has chapter three is my entire story of my upbringing, and I've got lots of skin in the game. And I certainly am not a person who I feel I can write about this. Not just because I studied communications and I was a communicator, but also because I've experienced very, very deep grief and loneliness in my life.
Spill the beans. Tell me more. What does that mean?
Oh, you didn't read? It's all of my traumas in here. Okay, so
I didn't know that side of you, actually.
I think that's one of the blessings of writing a book is that you really get to process and tie a bow on those experiences. And interestingly, since the book came out around the world and it's very well received and I feel so seen, I have not been compelled to actually talk about this. But there was a time maybe 8 years ago where all I could talk when I met with people was about my trauma. And that's how I knew that we had to do something about it. And I went to therapy and sorted out. So basically, when I was 19 years old, I watched my father die in front of me. And when I was 29, and I'll go back to the childhood stuff in a minute, but I want to paint the picture of how all these things get compounded. When I was 29, my mother was a very rare degenerative disease, had a huge, massive stroke that everyone with this disease gets, and ended up in a wheelchair. And I left my dream life and my dream job in Dubai to go back to Australia and care for her. And going back to care for her revealed a whole host of other traumas. You know, I essentially had run away from Australia and from dealing with all of those things. My mother had hoarding disorder. So hoarding disorder, I write about in the book, is also another extension of loneliness. It's filling space with things in place of human connection.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I was tasked with cleaning that for about 6 months in Australia from the morning to the night. And I write about the things that I found, the family secrets I discovered in that process. And if we go back to my childhood, you know, there was just lack of belonging all the way through from growing up as someone who was a person of color in a predominantly white city in Australia. So I thought I didn't belong in the community. And then I didn't feel I belonged in my own family because I'm mixed race. So I wasn't like the Chinese side of my family, nor was I like the Eurasian side of my family fully. And both sides would tell me that constantly. And then most of all, within my own family unit, you know, I had a mother who is and was very, very domineering, very avoidant in her attachment style, and could be cruel, very pressurizing. And I think predominantly, as we see with a lot of Asian parenting, there is a lashing of criticism and very little affirmation. And I think I used to think that this was pronounced for me because I lived in a Western country where everyone's parents were very openly affirming. But what I found when I started my own community in Singapore and I started writing and speaking and having a following write to me was that regardless of country, if your parent, and this is backed up by therapists the world over, but if your parent is constantly displeased and criticizing you, and as a child you're getting very little love and affirmation, that affects you, whether that is adjacent to openly loving Western parenting that you're seeing it juxtaposed with, or whether it's not. So that my mother was a Singaporean woman of her generation, and she has many amazing qualities that I talk about in the book, but her story and my story is really the love story of my life.
Wow. I'm reminded by what my partner Hannah we were talking the other week about how when a child cries and doesn't get response from the parents, it stops to cry. That was shockingly eye-opening for me. It's almost like saying simply that, okay, they're not coming, so I might as well just start to deal with this myself. And what you're saying here is almost what happens 15 years later or 20 years later, right? It's basically you having to either run away from it because you don't really have a chance that they'll ever show up, or then facing it at a point in your life because suddenly you go like, but they should have replied, shouldn't they have? And I think that's deeply defining of who you are. I mean, how did you find your way out? I mean, first of all, how did you find a way to acknowledge that to yourself?
I think, firstly, I was very, very lucky that my father loved us children in a very healthy way. So I had him until I was 19. Things really started to fall apart after he passed away, because therefore that balancing force was no longer there. And I think I talk about it in the book, but I could no longer keep the lid on my crazy. I talk about, I was like the pot boiling over on the stove. So I would have, exactly as I've talked about, I would have outbursts at people. I would cry every day. I just couldn't keep a lid on. I couldn't even interact normally with people anymore. And so I finally went for coffee with someone who's an actress here in Singapore, and her best friend is my therapist. And we're meant to have a normal coffee. And I didn't realize that I was so unstable and that I was crying all the time, but she did. And she gave me the number of this therapist. And the pain in me was so unbearable, Mo. Like every day it was painful just to be me. It was so uncomfortable just to be living and walking around, you know? And so I went to therapy. And so what everyone needs to realize is therapy is like going for a facial and thinking that you're going to come out afterwards with perfect skin. This is not how it works. It's going to pull all the gunk out of your face, and you're going to have extraction and bad skin for a while before your skin is amazing. And I went in ignorantly and I said, look, I'm here to just talk about this toxic workplace I'm working in. And then she's like, okay, but tell me about your childhood. And then this goes on. And she was really right, because that toxic workplace was a repeated pattern of my childhood home growing up. So I could see why being in that toxic workplace was far more triggering for me than for anyone else. It was still toxic for everyone else, but for me it was unbearable because it was an imprint of the childhood home. But I didn't understand any of this then. And that then became a four-year weekly therapy session that almost bankrupted me. It was so expensive. It's not covered in Singapore by any healthcare. But it was the most expensive, best thing I've ever done. And so I have this big thing now that I fly for the best courses in the world, and I fly for education, because I realize, wow, if that could transform, there would be no book, no flying around the world, five-figure speaking gigs like this. None of this would happen without that work. So if you want transformation, you've got to have skin in the game. There's no way that life gets better without a little bit of work. But it's almost now terrible, because now I have like a self-development addiction, because I think, how could that have transformed my life? And what else do I not know? So it made me very thirsty for education. But the awakening, the part where I thought, wow, at least 90% of this healing is done. And there's still obviously that 10% is going to go on for the rest of my life. But the 90% where I became able to function in the world for me was the moment I could see the blessings in my trauma. So for example, as a result of really finding my family home very uncomfortable growing up, I became incredible at creating families in every country I lived in. So I've got four girls in Switzerland. I've got four girls in Singapore, four girls in Dubai, four girls in Australia who are all a family that I built for safety because I did not feel safe in that home. So that's a gift. I have something called mind reading, which is what a lot of children with unpredictable primary caregivers developed. It's where you read the temperature in the house to keep you safe because you're always walking on eggshells, right? You don't want to be screamed at. You don't want to be shouted at. You don't want to be abused. So you are looking for even a temperature of the room when your primary caregiver is around. This has made me an incredible public speaker. I can read a room like it's a superpower. So all of these things, when I started to tally up the gifts of my trauma and how much I wouldn't have it any other way, and how, I mean, the book is dedicated to my parents. I wouldn't have had them any other way. It's still hard.
Yeah.
It's still hard. My mother can't speak. I was just in Perth with her. And even without speech, you know, I was putting moisturizing cream on her face last week and she swatted my hand away. Even without speech, she can be cruel. And the carer came in and said, Simone, she only does that with you. Wow. You know, she only does that with you. Because people who are avoidant, one of the traits of avoidance is they need love actually more than anyone else.
Correct.
But it makes intensity of it is so uncomfortable for them, so they will do anything to create distance again. So something so intimate, like her skin was flaking off, it was dry. I was doing something even her caregivers would do, moisturize her face. But an avoidant is wired to be the most cruel to those closest to them. So that, you know, that's still heartbreaking for me. I still have to manage.
How do you deal with that? How do you forgive that?
I forgive that because I know that she's carrying her own wounds. I forgive that because I know asking someone who's almost 80 to change who they are would be ridiculous. And I also manage my state very well. So part of the reason why when we're talking about the traveling and I don't like it is because it impedes my ability to connect with myself. Sometimes from flying, there's such pain in my body that it impedes me connecting with the pain that's in my heart. So like my neck and everything is so locked that I'm like, am I detecting that I'm completely triggered because my mother has just done this? Or am I in pain because I literally have a throbbing neck and my body's exhausted? So part of what I do when I'm in a great optimal state is I'm always connecting back to self and working out, okay, how is this triggering me? What can I do to feel better? So in therapy, one of the first things you'll learn is accessing tools that in that moment, I get healthy tools, not self-soothing, but healthy tools in that moment that are going to make me feel better. So normally that's hugging my puppy, reading a great book. Cocooning in bed is great. I'm a big fan of cocooning in bed, reading a great book. I don't see anything wrong with that sometimes when you need that and being silent and quiet. And so I try and access these things to lift me when those things happen, because reacting in that moment doesn't help. She's paralyzed in a wheelchair. Where can she go? You know?
Wow. It just shocks me every time how each of us comes with their tests and challenges and wounds. And you know, you see someone standing on stage and being very articulate about topic A, but they're still searching for topic B. And it's just so incredible how the human experience really is. And I, you know, at the end of the day, listening to you, I find that the only difference is a choice, because the human experience will send shit your way. It's just you have to make a choice in terms of how are you going to deal with that.
Yeah, I just did a video that's just gone viral on Instagram, and I said, I shot it sitting next to my mom, and I said, you don't get points in life for the sucky things you go through. You only get any form of gift in life from the grace with which you handle the sucky things you go through. And, you know, one of the things my publisher said to me when this book was coming out, and they're like, Simone, you don't look like a lonely person. And I said, well, this is why I'm the best conduit. If you look at Marilyn Monroe, very glamorous woman, one of the loneliest people in existence. We now have in America, like I said to you, one in three or one in five, right? Loneliness looks like every one of us. And I'm very vulnerable in the book, and I'm very vulnerable on stage, and I share the things I've just said to you, because it's important that everyone feels less alone in the fact that, you know, this is the human experience. This is the grief. And Mo, I don't even have to tell you this, you lost Ali, you know, grief and loss is part of the human experience, and once it's processed, it's actually a very powerful gift to connect with others in a less surface way.
I feel I shouldn't talk more, but I really want to ask for tips for those. So it's safe to assume that one in every three people listening to us feels lonely, right? So by the way, if you're that one and you know that about yourself, yeah, you're 30% of all of us, right? It's absolutely okay. If you don't think you're that one, then maybe think again.
One in three, I've just remembered, I should correct this, one in three Americans feel that they don't have someone that they can confide in.
That's the stat I remember, actually. They have no one at all that they can speak to if things are wrong.
But I think globally it's one in five. Yeah. Either way, if you're listening and either of those stats resonate with you, I'm hoping that I can bring some solutions to the table.
So solutions, let's talk about your top tips.
Okay. Solutions, number one, if you have been feeling very, very lonely, you know that you need to get out there and socialize. And this festive season, somebody invites you to something. I want you to remember that you are not obligated to go there and be the life of the party. A great way to re-enter is to have a service mindset. Service is one of the best things. It gives us perspective. It gives the lonely brain, which is irrational, perspective. I want you to tell yourself before you enter that room that you're going to be of service by listening. You have no idea in this narcissistic world we live in, if you can be of service to someone else by listening to them, how amazing that gift is for someone else. You're going to feel better. You're both going to get oxytocin, dopamine, but don't think you have to go in and be the life of a party and therefore you turn down the invitation. Go in, be reserved if you need to, and sit and just listen as someone else is disclosing about themselves. Everybody loves to talk about themselves. So number one, people have been socially isolated. You get invited. Please go and listen. Number two, you're feeling lonely. You want to start with baby steps. Okay. You feel very self-conscious. You've been out of socializing for a while. Start with those micro connections. Micro connections are an incredible gateway to deeper connection. So when you go into your barista at Starbucks, smile, nod, they're going to start a conversation with you. They're service staff. It's part of their training.
Yeah.
Rebound with a comment. Engage. And then because they're micro connections, you can bow out when it gets too much. If you don't even want to talk, going down the street, catch someone's eye, smile at them, acknowledge them. And don't be disheartened if you don't get it reciprocated. It's not personal at all. We're just living in a very lonely world, right?
Yeah.
If the loneliness is crippling, I urge you, it could be a symptom of something deeper, like what I was going through and unlocked a lot of other things that were happening. There are many helplines, but there are also great therapists available. And I understand that I was in a very privileged position to be able to afford the therapy I did. But depending where you are in the world, I know that there are different subsidies. Please don't be ashamed to go to a counselor or go to a therapist if you feel you don't have somebody in your circle you could trust to talk to. So these are my top three things.
These are incredible. And I actually have to say, they all start with a conscious awareness and a willingness or a decision to not feel that way, right? Not feel that way. As I always say, it's baby steps. You said that so openly, right? And sometimes major steps, like going to a therapist if you have to, is something that is definitely a game changer if you find the appropriate and skilled therapist that you need. But baby steps, you know, low stake conversations, talk to people in the elevators, you know, stand next to the water cooler at work and just say hi or smile or you know, ask for,
you take know, your AirPods out while you are walking. So if someone wants to approach to talk to you, they can.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's, you know, I actually do the opposite. So when I go to a cafe and I'm trying to write, I use my AirPods. I don't use AirPods. I don't like Apple. But,
I use I use a fully connected.
I use that are visible. Yeah, so that I can, it's literally a signal that basically says I need alone time. So you're just making it.
But I do that too, Mo, when I write in cafes. I do that too. But you know, on TikTok, the kids are calling it silent walking. So that means so many of them walk with headphones that having them out, it has been given a term called silent walking. I was like, do you just mean walking? But you know, that
helps. You just mean walking, that, exactly.
Yes, it's walking. It's walking. I love Gen Z, by the way. I love that they are less prejudiced than my generation. I love them. There are so much about them that I love. I love their open-mindedness. I love their creativity. There's so many things I love. But I will say, trying to take out the technology if you're feeling lonely so that you can be noticing the social cues of others and getting used to being back in connection is a good thing.
100%. Simone, I adore you. You're wonderful.
I adore you too.
Yeah. And it really is. It's your command of the topic, but your vulnerability that really makes you such a valuable, valuable teacher on the topic. I'm really grateful for your time. I urge everyone to read Let's Talk About Loneliness. It's definitely something that you need to be aware of, because it's either you or someone that you really care about who's feeling lonely. And really, you know, we need to address this as a society, because it's really going too far, if you tell me. Thank you so much. I know that you have something in 6 minutes, so I'll give you the time. Simone, thank you so much. If you're flying through Dubai, coming to London, or if I'm in Singapore, it's going to be green tea, not coffee.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's really my honor. Thank you all for listening. This was one of my favorite conversations of the year. It's always a wonderful conversation with Simone. I would ask you all to really take this seriously. Take those notes around the kinds of kinds of connections we're looking for, the signals that you might be lonely, and some of the tips and tricks that you can use to address a state of loneliness. There is a big difference between lonely and alone. When you're alone, this is your time to connect to yourself. This is one of the most important parts of the connection that you're looking for. And so, yes, absolutely one of my top skills at addressing my state of loneliness or the challenges of life or my emotional state because of how the world is today is to slow down, reflect and connect and take a few deep breaths and really think deeply about how you want your life to be, how your life actually is, and then plot a plan between them. It just takes a tiny bit of time for you to slow down. I keep asking everyone, the purpose of this podcast is to recognize that regardless of how busy you are this week, there will always be a tiny bit of time to slow down. Please do help me make the podcast more successful by sharing it, by rating it 5 stars, by telling your friends about the conversations that you enjoy, by liking, subscribing on the YouTube channel, which is growing really, really fast. Whatever it is that you do, you might actually help someone lonely find this conversation by telling them about the quality of the tips and advice that was in it. At the end of the day, I am really grateful that you keep listening to Slow Mo. I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.